You can definitely make a lineage from the Pistols gig through Buzzcocks to Joy Division to Tony to the Hacienda, the whole thing all the way through to what the city is now, encapsulate that spirit in bricks and mortar.
Meet John Robb. John's a musician, a writer, and a vegan eco-warrior who always champions the changing face of Manchester. John's journey in music began as a bassist and singer for post-punk band The Membranes. After moving to Manchester, he spent the past 30 years embedding himself in the music and culture of this city. He set up Louder Than War in 2011, and it's a magazine that combines his love of writing with a passion for helping other up-and-coming creatives. And you may have seen him on TV commenting on all kinds of music and culture. So I wanted to hear John's stories from being part of a key moment in music history. How has Manchester been defined by its music? And how did a punk kid from the Lancashire coast become a cornerstone of Manchester's music scene? I'm Lisa Morton, and this is We Built This City. John, welcome to We Built This City.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. So you're an adopted Manc. You were born in Fleetwood in Lancashire.
Yeah, I was born there, but I didn't grow up there. So it's a funny thing now, because, you know, Wikipedia has that, I don't know why I get in these things, but famous people from your town things, but they don't put me in the Blackpool one, and they always put me in the Fleetwood one, which is slightly annoying, because I actually was only in Fleetwood for 4 days. then I went home to Blackpool.
Oh, I see, I got you. It's like on my kid's passport. Nina, with my daughter, was telling me that I think she says she was from Davyhulme, but that was just where the bloody hospital was. That's kind of a lie.
I know, nobody ever knows where these places are, do they? At least some people know where Blackpool is.
They do, yeah. So how long were you living there?
For about 20 years, and I went to college at Stafford Poly for about a year, got thrown out and came to Manchester. So I lived here about 40 years. I lived here longer than I ever lived in Blackpool, but I still feel like I'm from Blackpool.
Oh, you do?
In a weird kind of way. Yeah. I guess half and half, like hybrid, like most people are, isn't it?
Yeah. But even we haven't got a beach. There's one up the road where you're from.
Yeah, but it's a funny kind of beach, isn't it? It's not the world's most scenic beach, is it? You know, Blackpool's a funny place to come from. I was just thinking this because I've been going around doing this talk about my life and the music, which will probably end up being a book at some point. And just thinking how weird it is coming from Blackpool, because no one, if you're from Manchester, people completely place you straight away. They go, typical Manc, don't they? Typical this and all that. And they have an idea what a Mancunian is. But when you say from Blackpool, people always say, I didn't know people came from there. They just think everybody goes there for their holidays. But there was quite a lot of people actually came from Blackpool, and quite a lot of people in music came from Blackpool as well. A really weird hodgepodge of people, like Jethro Tull, who actually ended up being one of the world's biggest selling rock groups of all time, could probably play the arena, actually, if they did a greatest hits album or something. And Dave Ball and the keyboard player from Pet Shop Boys. It's just this really weird sort of collection of people that came out of Blackpool, but it kind of punched above its weight. But growing up there, you think coming from a town that was basically a showbiz town, it'd be amazing, there'd be loads of gigs on, but there's no gigs on at all. It was all just and sort of everything for holidaymakers, and just like, it was like bad comedians that'd been on telly 5 years before and everything like that. So in the punk era, all the gigs were in Lancaster or Manchester, but we couldn't get to Manchester. So we're kind of stuck in this town where it was quite a big town, but nothing went on, so we had to make it up as we went along, really.
And you set the Membranes, or you launched Membranes from when you were in Blackpool?
Yeah, when we were just kids, you know, we were just, the drummer was 13, and I was like, what people forget about punk now is how young it all was, especially in towns, you know, in cities. When I first moved to Manchester, a lot of people, like my age or a year older or 2 years older than that, people, you know, like Peter Hook or whatever, or the New Order guys, they were a few years older. But when we were in Blackpool, apart from one other band, we were the oldest band, and I was 17. It was just like the first gig we played in a Northern Soul club because there was nowhere else to play, and we never played a gig before, and we had no idea what we were doing. We never plugged into amps, so we plugged in and thought, Jesus, that's loud. And we didn't know guitar, we didn't know scales, chords. We had like a bass riff, and that was the song, and everyone just played on top of it, all out of time. We never tuned up, we couldn't tune up. We just put the machine heads in a row on the guitar, and it was complete out of tune. But it was actually, in a way, a perfect moment of punk rock DIY. You just went and did it anyway. You had no idea what you're doing, but that didn't stop you doing it.
So what moment was it in your life when you at that age when you just thought, you know, I've got to be an artist, I want a band?
When people always say about careers, that it's not a career, I never had any idea of a career. You just make it up as you go along. And also, artist to me would seem a really odd word. It was just because you never thought of yourself as an artist. You were just doing things you really liked. And you honed it to your own idea of perfection, but I don't know if anybody else get that at all. It was just like having ideas and just doing them despite everything. And that's basically how I've spent the last 40 odd years.
We were saying before you came here how like you must be the busiest person in the world because the stuff that you've achieved and the stuff that you continue to do. I mean, you just never stop, do you?
I like ideas. You get an idea and you have to finish it. But it doesn't mean when you've got one idea, it just stops there. You have another idea and then another. And I get bored really easily. So, you know, some people will say, you know, why don't you take a night off and sit at home and watch the telly? You think, that's just the worst. That, to me, that'd be the worst nightmare ever. Like going on holiday and lying on a beach would be the worst idea ever. Maybe that's because I'm from Blackpool.
Yeah. I don't think the idea not that going, beach.
I came from a town that seemed to be on holiday all the time. Yeah, I wouldn't mind that beach at all. No, windswept. But then in the end, I like the way it was a really windswept, cold beach. You know, it's, Blackpool does have a certain weird beauty to it. You know, the Victoriana in it. And the weather, being cold and wet, is actually something I really like, you know.
And I mean, you've not really swapped out from Blackpool to Manchester, have you? Because we've got probably less wind, but we've got definitely got lots of rain.
Yeah, it's a lot of rain, but not it's not the rainiest city in the country,
it's not,
it?
No.
It's an urban myth, that. And the myth came because the mill owners used to come up once a year from London to check on their mills, but they go at Christmas and they go, Manchester's a really dark, dismal, rainy place, but they never went in the summer. You know, so they only came up there to check, you know, their slaves in the mills and things. But what we should do is all the water, all those places, all those people that used to laugh at us have been wet. We should charge them for the water. So all the people in the south would have to pay for the water.
Well, I tell you what, there's a lot on Dale Street car park. We've just had some water through to get into. It's all there.
Coming
all
down
there.
Here today, just like all the mad potholes are all completely full of water. So when you're cycling here, think, I'm not cycling through that. I don't actually know how deep that is. I could actually end up, you know, like hundreds of feet down or something.
I think I just...
You can see all the cobbles now, can't you? It's funny, even the cobbles are falling out the potholes.
It's that Manchester charm that we've got, that Victorian charm. So I've heard you say that Manchester did call to you from Blackpool. I mean, you obviously said Lancaster as well. So what made you make that move over?
Everyone I knew in Blackpool, because he wanted to do something in their lives, it had to be London or Manchester. That was the only choice he had. We used to go to gigs when we finally found a kid who had a car so we could get to gigs, and he was about 17. He was a year older than me and he had a car, and he was the most popular kid in Blackpool. There'd be about 10 people squashed in his car going to gigs, because all the trains, like now, the last train back was about like 10 or 10.30 to back to Blackpool. So you'd have to sleep all night in Victoria Station, not sleep, just lie on a bench and wait for the first train back. And it wasn't pleasant, because Manchester was pretty rough then, wasn't it? It wasn't, you know, as a 16, 17-year-old, spending all night at Victoria Station was not a pleasant experience, you know. So he was like the god of the town. So we went to gigs in Liverpool and went to gigs in Manchester. When you went to Liverpool then, if you walked around and people come up to you and go, hey, mate, what's the time? And you tell them, they get your accent and you would get attacked. It was quite mad in those days. Of course, you look punk as well, so everybody wanted to beat you up. But Manchester, nobody ever bothered you. So we felt more of an affinity with Manchester. Although I love both cities, you know. So it's but Manchester just felt more accommodating if we were from Lancashire or whatever. So we went to more gigs in Manchester and we got to know more people in Manchester. And there was a lot of connections in Manchester and Blackpool as well. So Joy Division, obviously, like they played Blackpool and that was an amazing gig. About 70 people there. It's just really mad, isn't it? Because people think Joy Division were like U2, like a massive arena band. The album was already out and there's still only 70 people there. But the other band that played, it was a band called Section 25, who were on Factory Records as well. And they're the only band that was older than my band. They were 25 years old. They were so ancient. We didn't know this, but we knew they knew Joy Division, but we didn't know how well they knew Joy Division. So every Sunday, Ian Curtis would be around their house, which is only a mile away from ours, and they're all in a psychedelic state of mind, shall we say. Yeah. So, and he produced their early tracks and stuff. And Tony Wilson would turn up occasionally in Blackpool at gigs, you know, and it was like, so we felt there was a very, very slight connection with Manchester. So it felt like we could join in with Manchester, really. So after college, I just moved to Manchester because of that, really, because there's a great music scene here. And we tried really hard to get a music scene going to Blackpool. And there was a good scene, there was a lot of bands, but as soon as it came to summer, you couldn't use any of the clubs because it became places for holidaymakers, you know, for grockles, as they were called locally.
Grockles, yeah.
I never actually know what a grockle means, you know, but it's a great word.
I've not heard that word for ages. And so where were you like hanging out and where would you be playing? What was Manchester like when you moved over here for the first time?
It's funny, when we finally moved here, it was actually in a, not a fallow period, but it was in the punk and post-punk period, there'd been loads going on here. And we got here 83, 84, 85, and it was a bit of a dip. There wasn't really as many bands coming through. The Smiths was kind of going on and that was it. And there were, so we got here and thought there'd be this massively vibrant scene, and it kind of shrunk a little bit from what it had been just a couple of years before. But already the roots of what was going to happen next were starting to appear. So when we start rehearsing in Manchester, I think it was 84, 83, we rehearsed in this rehearsal room out in Chawton. This other band, this very surly-looking band, we'd all walk in there, we thought they looked pretty hard then. And that was the Stone Roses. And so one day I broke a string, thought, oh God, I'm going to have to ask that band next door for a guitar string. And so I knocked on the door. Of course, they were dead friendly, you know. But then I looked around the room, the gloomy room, and in the corner I saw the late Pete Garnett, who was the bass player of the Stone Roses. I go, Pete, I didn't know this, because he told me he was in a band. I said, I didn't know this is your band. So then we got to know him really well, Matt. I mean, we could hear their songs coming through the wall as well. And they were different then. They were a bit more rocky, but they had really good songs and things. So they're the first band we actually really got to know in Manchester. They lived near us as well, because we lived in West Didsbury at the time, because it was like really bedsit land. It's different than for what it is now. It's cheap to live around there then, you know, and it's, you know, Burton Rose, the cool little scene. A lot of bands live around there, and you just get a flat for hardly anything. But, you know, those really horrible derelict flats with like really like paper thin walls and people stealing your mail and just those kind of weird people lived in bedsit lands, wasn't it? Yeah.
I lived in one in Eccles for a period of time. It wasn't my finest moment, to be honest.
No, it's like, it's different now. There's slightly more rules than there was then. You're thinking the fire hazards of it and stuff like that. Yeah. And in the winter it's freezing, wasn't it? And you have the bar heater. Another little fan heaters, wasn't it? And you go in and when you lie in your bed, you have to put the fan heater on the bed to warm it up.
Yeah,
that was thinking, God, it's so dangerous.
That was dangerous.
It?
And also cling film at the window with the hair dryers. Because there were gaps in the windows, honestly.
I remember I had a shared bath, and I remember getting in the bath and the side of the bath fell off and all my mail fell out. So that some guy downstairs who was stealing my mail was hoarding it in the you take the bath side of the bath off and hoard it in that space. What a weirdo.
What did he want with your mail? That's shocking.
I know it's weird. Well, they're weird. A lot of people live in bedsits are weird, aren't they?
Yeah. Yes. I don't go back there in my memory for too often. My dad kicked me out of the house.
Not
and
by choice.
Knuckles. No, not at all. And obviously you went on to write the biography of the Stone Roses, didn't you? So tell me about that.
That was a few years later. And they'd actually initially asked Mary Ann Hobbs to write the book, but rang me up and said, you should actually write this, which is very magnanimous of her, because you actually know them. So, because I had the story in my head, because I've been to all the early gigs, I've seen the early rehearsals, you know, so I knew them pretty well. So I knew the story from first-hand experience, which is a good start. Because then writing a rock book was not as easy as it is. No, it's not never easy, but it was easier now because you just Google a lot of stuff, but then you'd have to actually find it out. So it's all right for someone to read that book now and go, well, actually, John Squire didn't play a gold guitar on that gig. You go, yeah, but I didn't know that then. Yeah. I mean, how would you find out? I'd have to go ring him up. He wouldn't remember either. So, whereas now it's just full of, it's insane the amount of information on the internet. And in fact, it does make about writing a book harder when I think about it, because how do you get more information in your book than it's actually online? I mean, how do you contextualize it in a way that's ahead of what's already on the internet? Because if you're a fan of a band, you just dredge it all off a phone in an afternoon, can't you? But then you couldn't do any of that. So you had to sort of know the story and interview the people that would do interviews, because bands don't like doing interviews about their own careers. There's lots of bits they don't really want to talk about, and lots of bits they can't remember, or lots of bits where they're on myth. If you ever see an interview, say, like Paul McCartney, he tells you the Beatles story from the Beatles biographer's version of the story, because it gets all merged up in people's heads, doesn't it? And the actual memory of what happened it's been retold so many times, you can't even remember the true version yourself. So how do you work all that out, you know? But so with that book, it was different sort of context of times. But I also wrote about Manchester and the scene and what it was like at the time, things like that. And because I was at those gigs and I've got a really good memory, I could actually flesh it out by first-hand accounts of being there as well. But I mean, and there was loads of stuff. I mean, Pete Garner, actually, he was the band's hoarder and he had all the stuff. So he was good. So he had like all the original demos, original rehearsal tapes and everything. So he wouldn't give them to me. I didn't want them because they're personal items, aren't they? But he would play them when I went around his flat and stuff. So I'm one of the few people who's ever heard that stuff. Wow. So it was a very deep dive. But I think when you write books, I mean, there's two ways of doing it. You could do the overview story, or you can just get completely down the rabbit hole, which is my kind of book.
Yeah. And were they completely open to you doing that?
They didn't want to do it. They didn't want to do interviews for it, but right. They were cool me doing the book, you know. But I already interviewed him about four or five times. Yeah. It wasn't like I didn't have interviews. I mean, I've got a really brilliant interview with Ian Brown that's about 90 minutes long, and he told me the story of his life, which he actually did for another book I did, which was an oral history of Manchester music, and he did an interview for that book, so I could use that in the Roses book and things. They were cool me doing it because they knew me, you know. And I also think when you write a book like that, I mean, they're such a mythological band, you know. The myth of the Roses is such an important part of the story. You don't want to over-puncture the myth, you know. You sort of tell the truth of the story and how it all comes together. But you don't want to ruin the myth, do you? Because in the end, all bands are just basically a bunch of people in a room. You know, if you watch The Beatles Get Back, that's what like being a band is. Even the biggest band of all time is sat in a freezing cold room and they're all sat there looking at each other at 10 o'clock in the morning trying to do something amazing. And it's not coming, is it? They're sitting there going plonk, plonk, plonk. You know, it's like everyone's going, I really don't want to be here. It's really boring. Oh my God, where did that come from? Yeah. That sounds amazing. It's what it's like being in a band. But how do you make that into a book? You know, so the myth is actually, you have to have the myth as well. I think the myth is really important in music, isn't it?
I love that perspective, yeah. And it's so true. I mean, anyone that's like amazing at their art, there's so many boring hours.
Oh, loads of boring
discipline
hours.
And you just don't see those bits.
Yeah, you know, imagine Picasso would probably spend a week mixing his paints together in a really bad mood and being just a terrible person to be with. And then he goes up to the canvas, goes dirt, dirt, and he goes, oh God, I see where this is going. That moment of magic and that moment of creation is what I'm completely fascinated in. You get them yourself, of course, because you get ideas. You don't know where they come from and you follow them through. But when you interview other people, and the only bit I'm really interested in is where does that amazing moment of magic come from, you know? And most people have no idea, do they? You know, if you interview Peter Hook, I say, you know, he's quite bluff hooky, and that's what's great about him. But he writes really beautiful bass lines, which are really not like him as a person. I go, where does that come from, Hooky? It's nothing like you at all. And he goes, I haven't got a clue. I just hit it and it just sort of comes out, you know. And that thing where the art is actually almost like another person leaning over your shoulder, moving your hands around, it's quite fascinating, isn't it?
Absolutely. And you strike me as somebody who's like a really curious person. So it's clear that you're really interested in how other people tick and what their motivations are.
Oh yeah, massively, yeah. I mean, I think with anybody, isn't it? It's not just people and bands, but anybody at all. For me personally, as a music writer, a lot of times when you interview other people, you're trying to find out yourself, why do I like this stuff? Because your music taste is so insanely eclectic and it doesn't make any sense at all, does it?
Yeah.
Some of the music you like is completely rubbish, but you love it as well, don't you? As much as you like something that's super cool. And I never trust anybody who's their music taste is only 10 cool records. You know, if you go to somebody's flat, and it's usually blokes, this, isn't it? But they have the perfect record collection. And there's not one record in that collection that's not as enough. So would he be thought of as a guilty pleasure, whatever?
Yeah.
They've hidden that in the other room, haven't they? I think that tells you an awful lot about that person, doesn't it? But not in a good way. You know, because some of the greatest records ever made are the really stupid ones, aren't they? And I want to know why I like that as well, you know. Because I don't understand how that can connect me as much as something that's completely brilliant. And I think, to me, that's the eternal mystery of music, isn't it? It's so beyond any understanding. So you waste your whole life trying to understand it.
It's so true. And it takes you back to a certain time, doesn't it? I mean, I used to go to Salford University to the gigs there because there was always like good music on. And then my friend's dad bought Corbiers when we were 17. So like, we were the coolest kind of kids and we used to go and listen to that jukebox the whole time. But the stuff as well that just takes you back to a moment in your life, doesn't it? And you didn't necessarily go on through the rest of your life following that kind of genre of music. I mean, I think back to the stuff, you know, I grew up on jazz music and the Beatles, but then I was like, I'd love some punk. And then I loved, obviously, you know, that you got the Charlatans and the Smiths and all of that amazing music that forms you as a person, doesn't it, as a young person?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the levels it works on. They're like snapshots of time, aren't they? say you go and see Oasis and they play Live Forever, and the whole audience are almost in tears, aren't they? Because it reminds them of a moment of time when they were 17 and they thought they were going to live forever.
Yeah.
Because that's what that song's kind of about, isn't it? That eternal youth, that moment of time in your life, you're completely free and you could do loads of mad stuff. You could take loads of mad drugs. You could stay up for 4 days and do loads and loads of crazy shit. And often, nothing ever happens, does it? No. You know, and you feel brilliant and you feel like this is going to last forever.
Yeah.
And that's what a lot of people go like, you know, the sniffy Oasis not being sophisticated songwriters. But when a song like that, Noel Gallagher, captures something that's so profound and so deep but in a very simple way. And I think that's the kernel of pop genius, to be able to capture a feeling without over-egging it. You know, everyone knows what it's about, but no one can actually explain it. And it is that feeling of the forever. And I always think Sex Pistols Anarchy in the UK is a very similar song in a sense. It's not a manifesto for anarchy. It's not a political song, really. It's actually a song about being completely anarchic when you're 17 and just living forever. It's the same thing.
Same thing.
So for somebody my age, when I hear that, it reminds me of a moment where it was eternal, the eternal moment, isn't it? Which is, if you can slow time down and actually stop it dead, and you're in that moment forever, it's almost like a piece of Zen Buddhism, but done as a powerful piece of rock and roll music, isn't it? And it's really profound, I think. When people talk about the politics of pop, and there's a lot of great politics in it, et cetera, but me, the most political thing is probably that, you know, that thing that also makes people feel 10 foot tall. So another example of Oasis is Rock and Roll Star. It could be a song about them, but actually it's a song about the audience.
Yeah.
It's about that when you're 18, your first night out in town, you go around town, you're a bit off your head and you feel like a rock and roll star. And it's really simplistic, but it's a really beautiful feeling, isn't it? Because it empowers everybody to have that moment in time when they feel like they're godlike, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Which I think is a really amazing thing for pop music to do. I'm not saying all pop music has to do that, but the moments when it does that are really profound and they stay with you all your life, don't they? So for me, it will be, initially it was glam rock. A lot of those songs were a soundtrack to being a young, you know, a pre-teenager into early teens. And then punk rock, because it was so life-changing. I mean, empowered me to dare to go and do something, you know, and I'll always owe it a debt to do that. And my duty, I guess, from being in that space is any young band I ever meet who've got the slightest inkling being any good, I feel like it's my duty to empower them and say, come on, I'll give you this great review. I'll tell you to go and speak to that person, do that. Your band's amazing. And I feel that as well. It's not a fake feeling, that energy, that thing where you can lift people up. And I think then you could take that beyond music, can't you, in a political way, can't you? You know, empower people and make the world feel better, because the world's always depressed. It's really odd. And I know these are really fucked up times, but we can't sit here and go, it's really fucked up, and give up.
No.
You know, my punk rock spirit, so it's a duality though, isn't it? Because part of your punk rock spirit is going, yeah, everything's fucked, so it doesn't matter. But the other half is, why don't we do something about it, you know?
I agree. I mean, just going back to Live Forever, you've just made me think about something that I've not thought about for a long time, but I did exactly that when that came out. I remember it was a summer night. At the time, I was living with my boyfriend in a terraced house in Swinton, and we'd diffused around a few Red Stripes, and we ended up staying up all night, Sunday night. And it was one of those long summer evenings where it hardly ever got dark, dancing around the garden. And I ended up getting thistles stuck in my feet and couldn't go to work the next day because I was so hungover and I couldn't walk because I literally my feet were both full of spikes.
But it's the best feeling in the world.
I'll never forget that night. And it was at that time.
I think as a songwriter, if you can write a song that creates that memory, it's the most perfect song, isn't it?
Unbelievable. Yeah. And obviously, a lot of Manchester's music tradition has come out of the fact that it's been about activism. You know, if you go back to the 70s, 80s and 90s, there were very few clubs. All the buildings were black. So there's a real sense of, from the 70s, wasn't there, you know, this is a crap place, we need to work our way out. A very working class kind of activism around music. How much of that do you think was important in creating such beautiful kind of seminal music that's come, that's part of our history now?
I think it's an important part of it, but also it's the music actually helps spark the next part of the story. So I think there's a 60s Manchester in there, and that's like one music scene, isn't it? And like the Hollies, who were a great band, and you know, that was a really important band, great singles band. But I think the post-punk thing is the story here, really, isn't it? And the Pistols gig and the way it was a catalyst for everything that changed afterwards, wasn't it? And I think Tony Wilson is obviously important that as well, because of So It Goes, I think it was just such an amazing programme to have the Sex Pistols' first ever TV appearance in Manchester. You know, 10 weeks before the Bill Grundy show, you know, which is the famous one, but we'd already seen him, you know, so that was pretty cool, wasn't it, really, when you think about it. So culturally, it was starting to move ahead in a sense. Buzzcocks taking punk out of London and putting it into Manchester, and then by extension, the world. So instead of being a London in crowd of bands controlled by three or four managers in the music business, it suddenly became this thing that was for everybody. I mean, the Buzzcocks were genius and unattainably brilliant, but the idea they put their own record out, that was inspirational for us in Blackpool. We thought, wow, you can make your own record. I didn't have no idea you could do that at all. And that's because of Buzzcocks Spiral Scratch. You know, that was a revolutionary thing. You know, whereas now, you know, somebody's 18 now will go, well, I don't really understand that. Why don't you just put it online? But then to make your own music seemed impossible. You'd have to go to a record label and grovel on the floor, you know, and say, please put my record out. Well, but the Buzzcocks thing seemed to say to us, just put it out. It wasn't easy, but there was a way. There was an endpoint where you could go and do it. So I think all that was important, Manchester. I think there was I mean, Joy Division reflected a certain type of Manchester because it was a broke city, but I don't think they ever went in a rehearsal room and said, why don't we write a soundtrack for a broken city, you know? Yeah. I think it was a pervading darkness of a city that was in a post-industrial phase, but that's not part of their thing. I mean, especially because Ian Curtis, who was a visionary of Joy Division, he was the one who had the vision and the idea of the band and what it should sound like, etc. And he didn't write the music, but it was his overarching, you know, futuristic vision. But he was in Macclesfield. He went to Macclesfield Grammar. He lived in Macclesfield, and Macclesfield was not a broken town then. So, he lived in Manchester for bits and went back there again. But I think it'd be unfair to say that he was writing songs about Manchester per se. But I think being that because of the inclement weather, because the skies are nearly always grey, etc., that's all in there, isn't it? It's not, but nobody actually sits there in a room, does a painting of their surroundings. It just affects you in a subtle kind of way. But the other thing is about something like Joy Division, which I think is true of a lot of Manchester music. There is a melancholy to it, but there's also euphoric as well. I don't listen to Joy Division and feel really depressed afterwards. I feel really uplifted because it was almost like staring down the darkness, wasn't it? And sort of being triumphant over the darkness.
Yeah.
And even the really up Manchester bands. So you listen to the first Rosie's album, it's a really euphoric record, but it's got a melancholy to it as well. I've always been fascinated by that. A lot of the Manchester bands, and probably a lot of the bands across the north actually, could do this. You know, their music could be up and down, all mixed together at the same time. It wasn't just purely up music or purely down music. It's a lot more nuanced and sophisticated than even the bands realise a lot of the time, isn't it? And I think the music was really important. I think it played, the music eventually empowered the whole city, didn't it? So it went from being the world's first industrial city to world's first post-industrial city into what I would always like to say is world's first post-punk city. So the whole skyline now looks like Peter Saville's artwork for the first Joy Division album. It's like sleek, linear lines, isn't it? The whole city looks like the Hacienda, apart from the Hacienda, which is not there anymore.
It's some very unfortunate looking flats now, isn't it there?
Well, it's weird because they rebuilt the building in the same shape.
Yeah.
But the flat, I mean, it's fine, it's flats. I think it's great there's flats in town. I must be the only person my age who likes the fact there's loads of flats in the city centre. I mean, I can't afford any of them, but I like them being there, and I like going in the city centre, and it's thousands of people there. And I remember when I used to have a dog, and I used to walk it around town when I lived in Hume, and you never see another dog. And you go to shops, and the shops would shoo you away. Right now, you go out, you sit outside home or something on a summer night, and there's hundreds of people walking dogs around.
You can't get a seat anywhere because all the dogs are all the seats.
Yeah. And it's really civilised, isn't it? It's like living in... I remember going to Holland on tour in 1985, and it seemed like weird because everyone had... All the cities were really civilised and everything worked, and everything in England was broken and knackered, wasn't it? And it's like, why can't we have a city that's like that, you know?
Yeah.
You know when people go to New York and go, it's amazing, it's all these massive buildings everywhere, then they come back to Manchester and moan about when we have them. That's such a British thing, isn't it? Other people can have stuff and we can be complete awe of it, but no, it's not for the likes of us.
No.
You know, but I like the way Manchester's got that ambition. I think it was born out of that period as well. I think you can definitely make a lineage from the Pistols gig through Buzzcocks to Joy Division to Tony to the Hacienda, the whole thing all the way through to what the city is now, encapsulate that spirit in bricks and mortar, and it.
Given the fact that on the face of it, it's not a melancholy city anymore. And some people would say, you know, we've got to a point of gentrification, which is meaning that some people, there's no place for them, some of our own, there's no place in the city centre now to live. How does that impact on the music we can create as a city region now if we've got pretty much everything we'd ever need? Well, some of us.
Well, actually, the gentrification thing's interesting because there's always problems with gentrification, isn't there? Yeah, because there's always underlines the haves and the have-nots, doesn't it? But the fact is, no one's really been moved out of the city centre, have they? Because no one actually lived in the city centre, did they? The closest you could get to the city centre and live in a cheap space was Hume, you know, for years. And even Hume still got bits of it that's still quite cheap to live in. I don't think anywhere in London you could get that near
close,
to a city centre living, like the Red Bricks in Hume, still super cheap to live in. Mm. All my mates live down there. I lived in the same flat for about 30 years, you know, and it's... I actually bought it for nothing because no one wanted to live there. And the price of it's hardly gone up.
Really?
Yeah, it stayed about 120,000 what it's worth for about 10 years.
Right.
Because there's so many new flats in town, isn't there?
Yeah.
But it's, and they built the Hacienda where they built it. One of the factors was because it was near Hume, because that was the only, that's where the alternative people lived, and they would walk,
to
the Hacienda and back again. So, and then when they built that, that was built on the edge of the city centre. But now the city centre goes on for another 4 miles. And I think there's always problems with building things. Of course, it's a drag when you can't get down the roads because they're digging it up and building new buildings on it and all that. But I quite like it because I like change and I like things that aren't static, you know. So if I go to the other end of town, if I've not been there for ages, you think, wow, that's all new. Right, where I live, you know, I'm only, we're actually during the lockdown, they built massive student towers right next to where I live, like 16-story towers, which is really funny because everyone in my block, they had a petition against them building a tower. And I said, I'm not signing that because we live in a tower. How can I say I'm against towers? I'm on the 8th floor of a 12-story old block in Hume. I have no problem. They go, students are noisy. I go, Jesus, when do you get to be such an old person? You know, I like the students being noisy. I don't think they're noisy enough. I think
they're not anymore.
No, you know what I mean? They're all swatting. If I was 19 now, the state of the world, I'd be going crazy every night. Yeah. I don't mind if it's 4 a.m, they're all out in the street screaming. I think that's great to hear young people. Living forever, basically. Back to that thing again, isn't it?
I agree. Yeah. Although a lot
if you didn't want the noise, I'd go and live in the suburbs.
Yeah. So what about Night and Day Cafe?
Well, that's a long and weird story, isn't it? And there's a lot to that story.
There's a lot to it. That is a nuanced story, yeah.
But I'm really glad it's still there. I'm really glad they found a way of making that work somehow. Now I see this stuff online, all these myths going on, like... you know, Manchester City Council trying to close all the venues in Manchester. No, they're not. That's not true. So how come there's no all the venues in Manchester? There's more venues in the middle of Manchester now than there ever was. And people go, you just made it up. I go, no, I've been going to gigs in Manchester since 1985. I know all the venues. I've been in all the venues. And in the late 80s, there's about 5 venues. There was a couple at the university. There was a Boardwalk, the 2 Internationals. The Hacienda would put some stuff on. And that was about it. You know, like now, there's about 40 or 50 venues in the city centre, and somehow they managed to make these things almost work. They put loads of flats in the city centre, and city centres are changing. This is the thing that people don't get. A city centre is not what it used to be. It used to be a place that people go and work and shop and go home out to the suburbs at 5 o'clock, the old model. But now a city centre, the city centre itself is now the biggest suburb in Manchester, isn't it? So they change, and in a way, it's hard to make a noisy venue exist in that space, but somehow... they do exist in that space and there's more of them. So I actually think power to the council, probably to people like Sasha Lord, who I actually think does a great job of making this somehow all work, isn't it? You know, the nightlife in Manchester is insane, isn't it? I think the only thing is, I don't think the music scene, it's got as big, it's got loads of bands and the music scene is important, but it's not that, I don't think music scenes are the centre of culture anymore. So that thing when Joy Division felt like, even though they were only playing to 90 people everywhere, that you did know at that time they were changing everything, and the way the Roses and the Mondays changed stuff and the Smiths. You know those bands that were really generational signpost bands? They don't come out of Manchester anymore, but they don't really come out of anywhere. I think pop music now, its role in culture has changed, and it's not the front of culture, it's the soundtrack to other stuff.
Yeah.
So it's like if you're a kid and, you know, if you're 18 and you're doing gaming, you've got music on, but the game is more important than the music. It's just part of gaming or part of your socials and that. So its role has changed. Whereas we were growing up, it was the number one.
It was, yeah, absolutely. It was like the soundtrack for your life, wasn't it? Completely. I used to listen to music all the time. I think I've heard you talk on another podcast where about, you know, this generational approach to music now, where you can have 3 generations. Some of the older bands, they're now coming back and they're doing the big gigs and they've got this whole resurgence, but you've got granddad, dad and kid
it's like having your audience tripled.
Yeah.
But and that's got, in a way, the going to see old punk bands is weird because it was such a teenage music, but now it's old people's music, isn't it? But it's generational, people bring the kids. Whereas my dad, he would never take me to go and see something, you know, that would just be so weird.
Absolutely.
I never
not
had to get away anywhere, my dad, you know. Yeah. And like the idea that all these mad punk kids at the time now bring the families out to the punk gig. If you try to explain that in 1977, people just think you're completely insane.
Hilarious.
Yeah. But I quite like that as well, because music is a social thing and it should never have been generational. It's like, it doesn't matter how old you are. If you like it, you like it, doesn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, well, my son, who he's always had this incredibly kind of eclectic interest in music. And when he started driving, which did scare the life out of me, I used to listen to what he had on the car. And it was stuff that was like predated me, you know, this range of music, which I think is brilliant. But kind of it's in your DNA, isn't it? Maybe what your parents have listened to, what you've heard. And it was funny because it was a few years ago, but we went to, when Duran Duran brought a new album out and we went to the Manchester Arena. And obviously because there's loads of old people there, all the seating was in there's no one standing up, everyone's seated in the thing. Yeah. And every time they played a new song, everyone left. I went to the toilet either because I had weak bladders or what, but they weren't interested. But it was all the old stuff that clearly, you know, everyone wanted to hear, the legend songs.
I know bands moan about that, but at least they've got the hits to sell out the arena.
Well, yeah, and it's those hits that do sell the arena.
Yeah, you know, if you're in a band that doesn't have hits, you have the luxury of playing new stuff and the audience gets that. And it's your core audience who like... they like what you do, so they don't expect you to play any old songs. And that's great in an art way, but it's hard work because it's always a core audience. Whereas Duran Duran probably go, they didn't like the new songs, get upset, but really they should be appreciated if they could play the arena. It's a bit more of a comfortable lifestyle when you're in your 60s, isn't it?
Yeah, very true. So tell me about Louder Than War, because that's obviously, you launched that around 2011, I think I read. And, you know, you're giving a voice there to young artists, aren't you? So why is it so important to you?
Well, I was writing for a few other websites, but I had so many ideas, I couldn't get them all in because you can't get them all onto one website. So I just set my own up. And it was just going to be me writing it first, but then people started saying to me, I'll do some stuff for you. So it became like that. Really, it's back to when I did a fanzine when I was a kid. It's an online fanzine, but you don't print up 3,000 and sell them. You just get thousands of people reading it every day. And it's not set up. It's a space, basically. It's not an office. You know, it kind of exists on phones. You know, you put it all together and but then we have really good editors on it, so we have a lot of people who can filter the stuff through there. And the idea, it's not just young bands, it's anything. It's for fans, it's a fanzine. It's a space where people can write about music they love and things. It's quite contradictory, the stuff that goes up on it, you know. But it's a really good space for people to learn how to hone their skills. There's quite a few young writers that have gone on to have proper careers. Because we always say to people, like, just write for us now. When you've really got this damn good, you need to get on to stuff like The Guardian if you can, because they could pay you properly, you know, because we don't have any money, you know, as a website. So it's probably the first space where people learn how to be writers and things. And some people stay, you know, even when they go on to have other careers, they still write for us as time. And photographers as well, same thing with photographers and that. And as the years gone by, the team of writers and photographers is a really good high standard. And it's all done out of the love of it, really, you know.
And that's also kind of going back to that the values you were saying before about the fact that you really believe in helping young people come forward and give them that opportunity.
Yes, it's what's helping anybody, actually. It's not just young people. Yeah. Last week we had this 16-year-old kid sat in our clinic, and he was like, Jesus, this is an amazing piece of writing. We can't tell you, we'll have to ask this kid for advice how to write properly. It was so good. But it could be somebody who's 60-odd and never written before and always wanted to do it. There's no filter, you know, it's like... everybody's welcome in there, you know, because music's for everybody, isn't it? We're not snobs, you know, I know we should be snobs because then you get an aesthetic, but I have an aesthetic, but I don't think my aesthetic's better than anyone else's. It's just perfect for me, isn't it? But I don't think that somebody else walks a room, oh God, look at them. Oh God, look at their record collection. It's rubbish. I just don't understand that way of thinking. I'm confident enough in what I do not to look down on anybody else, you know, which I think is actually very Manchester in a way, isn't it?
Very.
It's one of the things I really like about the city. It's not a snobby city, is it? You know, now they talk about opening like VIP clubs in the centre thing. That's not Manchester. I know people go to that.
It's ever really worked here, has it?
No, it doesn't. I hope it doesn't work. You know, I don't like that idea. I know they do have little roped off areas and clubs, but only idiots sit in there. Because in Manchester, it's all about everyone's in the same pot. Yeah. And that's what's really great about it. You know, when I go to my gym, there's multimillionaires in there and mad lads from Salford with little things around their ankles because they're trying to get on the straight and narrow and they haven't got there yet. And that's how Manchester should be, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's all different races, creeds, colours, everybody, totally different people, all in one room, and nobody even notices it. It's not even a political statement, and that's what makes it probably the best city in Europe, because London has that as well, but London's got VIP stuff and doesn't really do that here, does it? You can go out of here now and probably bump into Gary Neville, no one's even noticed he's there, you know, or some old mate you haven't seen for 40 years who's probably on the streets now, and that's what's good about it. So it's not good the person's on the streets, but what's good about it is everybody is in the same pot, isn't it?
Definitely. And I think that, you know, the whole thing here is everyone reaches out to help each other, don't they? In most cases. And
yeah, I think, and it's a cliche, isn't it? Yeah. It's friendly, but it actually is. You don't realise how friendly it is to go to London. And it's funny, isn't it? You go in a shop and go see your mate and the person behind the counter starts around and you go, who are you talking to? Or the other weird thing that people in the North do, which is so ace, is always say thank you to the bus driver, isn't it?
Yeah, you go, of course. Stop,
thanks, mate. And like, you're doing London and it's like, they're ringing the cops up, aren't they? There's a nutter on the bus. You know, when you go in the tube and no one talks to each other, it's really odd. If you had tubes in Manchester, it wouldn't be like that, would it?
No, absolutely not. So you've written two books recently. So you just started your spoken word tour.
Yeah. So yeah, I did a History of Goth book last year. So I toured that all year. And that's still ongoing, actually. That's mm-hmm. going really well. Now, started a spoken word tour about my adventures in life and music. So I've done about three of those and I'm back out again this week, so that's going to keep me going up to the summer and things. So there's that, and it's, I'm still trying to put this Green Britain Academy together where we train people up in green and eco jobs. So we're doing that with Staffs University, the university I got thrown out of, actually, which is quite ironic. So about a year and a half ago, they got in touch and said, do you want a doctorate? And they actually gave me my degree that I never finished in the first place. So I had to go there and dress up in a mad orange outfit with a hat on and do a little talk.
That's
and
brilliant.
They actually gave me the degree, which is so hilarious, isn't it?
Right, so listen, I've got some quick fire questions for you. So what's your favourite venue that you've played at or you've been to in Manchester?
Ritz.
Love the Ritz. If Greater Manchester was a genre of music, what would it be?
Indie.
Three words to describe Manchester.
Wet, positive, forward-thinking, never finished. Isn't that great quote? Didn't they ask somebody... And from the city, you know, when the people run the city, all this building's get my nerves. When's it finished? And he goes, Manchester's never finished. I just love that idea.
Like
it's never
that.
Finished. You know,
I wonder if that was the Howard Bernstein. Maybe.
I think it's Howard Bernstein. Yeah. That was it. You know, you look at History City and you think in the 18th century, it must have been amazing to be here when it made that big move, when it became a major city. You think, wow, I'm actually in that bit.
Yes.
Now it was a bit like the in punk when you felt like this is a cultural moment. I'm a kid, I'm right in the middle of this cultural moment. I'm not in the middle of it, I'm on the edge of it, but I'm in it, you know, my version of it. And then when Manchester and the acid house thing kicked off in Manchester at that point in time, it was like being San Francisco in 67. It's one of those things you'd always read about, or London when punk started in 76. Those moments where everything changed really quickly and every day things were changing. You think that must be amazing to be in that. And when I was writing for Sounds and I was in the middle of it and I was the person writing about it, I thought, oh my God, I'm actually in the middle of this thing. This is crazy. Yeah, right in the eye of the hurricane. It was so exciting. Yeah.
What do you order at the chippy?
Growing up Blackpool, I've had so many chips when I was a kid, I've never wanted another chip in my life.
Do you know, to be fair, my dad and mum used to drive us to Blackpool for the Illuminations and we always went. So there's an amazing chippy on the way back. And they were great.
It's funny when you go back to Blackpool because he still have loads of chippies.
Yeah.
There's hardly any chippies now. In Manchester, you don't really see a chippy. But in Blackpool, they still have one on virtually every single corner. And I do like it in a sentimental way, but of course, because I'm vegan, I can't get anything in a chippy anyway.
And what do you miss most about Manchester when you're not here?
Change.
Oh, interesting. No one has said that. Well, that's great.
Yeah, because you come back and it's completely changed again, isn't it?
Yeah.
And people.
Yeah.
I think it's always been about the people, Manchester. Yeah. Even when the city's really derelict, it was still the best place because the people are amazing, aren't they? So people are always up to something, doing something, aren't they, despite everything. Yeah.
Love that change. So thank you so much for joining me on We Built the City. And it's been a privilege to speak to you. And literally, we could really do the series on you because there's just so much. What you've covered creatively and musically is incredible. And you're a huge inspiration for, you know, people coming through. So thank you and good luck with everything that's coming up.
Yeah. We Built the City on Indie Rock.
John Robb built the city by keeping the spirit of punk alive in Manchester, by avoiding the potholes with the cobbles falling out of them, and by always saying thank you to the bus driver. John and I recorded at the Co-op Live HQ in the Northern Quarter. You can hear all about the development and opening of the brand new arena in my conversation with Sam Piccioni, Vice President of the Oakview Group, the company behind the build. Just go back to Mank 85 in the We Built the City feed. On the next episode of We Built the City, you'll hear from another born, bred or adopted Mank, and that episode will be available on the 18th of April. Follow the podcast on Instagram at We Built the City Pod so you can see pictures of all our guests in their favourite places around Greater Manchester. This podcast was produced by Purposeful Podcasts. If you want to build a community around your business or your brand, please do get in touch with our amazing team through our website at purposefulpodcast.com. If you'd like to find out more about how Roland Ransfield can help you drive your values and create relationships that build your business success, then head over to rdpr.co.uk. Or you can find us on Instagram at Roland Ransfield or X at rdprtweets. Or feel free to give us a call at the office on the same number we've had for nearly 28 years on 0161 236 1122. And in the meantime, please don't forget to rate, review and follow We Built This City. Thank you.